I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. 15 years ago, about 45% of teenagers were able to find summer jobs. Today, the teen employment rate is about 30%, with urban teens faring worse than their suburban counterparts. The employment rate for young black males in Philadelphia was about 10% last year. That's according to a new report from Drexel University titled Left Behind: Jobs Recovery Bypasses Philadelphia Teens. Teenagers are competing with older workers and still dealing apparently with the aftermath of the recession. While the economy has added about 11.5 million jobs since 2010, young people have largely been left out of the recovery. Today on Radio Times, we talk about job opportunities for teenagers and what employment, even short-term employment like a summer job, can teach them. And we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Paul Harrington is director of the Center for Labor Markets and Policy that released the study I just quoted, and he's a professor in the School of Education at Drexel University. And Paul Harrington, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marcy.
Nice to have you with us. And Chikima Fulmore Townsend is president and CEO of the Philadelphia Youth Network. And Chikima, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And rounding out our trio of guests is Sarah Heller. She's an assistant professor in criminology at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies interventions to reduce crime and improve other life outcomes among disadvantaged youth. In fact, it's a very interesting study we'll be talking about when she was in Chicago. And Sarah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Paul, let me begin with you, and even going back to your study and even what I was reading in preparation for the show, which is, you know, 15 years ago, around the year 2000, almost half of teenagers were able to get summer jobs. Today is closer to 30%. Where have these jobs gone?
Well, I think part of it is, if you look over the, particularly 1980 to 2000, the American economy generated lots of employment opportunities. There was, you know, a rising tide really did lift a lot of boats, including teens. And kids are at the margin of the job market, you know, that they're the first to get let go, last to get hired. And the last 12, 15 years have been tremendous economic turbulence. So I think because these kids are at the bottom of the queue, they've had a tougher time finding employment. And so there's been substitution for teens by other groups for teenagers in these entry-level jobs, you know, jobs that all of us could go do right now. You know, you just have to have a good attitude and the like. And so what you find is that still we have a lot, you know, still substantial shares of college grads that don't get college labor market jobs or bumping into entry-level positions. Second thing is lots of older workers now, particularly 65 to 74, interestingly, are penetrating back into teen, you know, kind of entry-level jobs in retail. And then the third group that we're seeing is some foreign-born workers still at the entry level, particularly in some of the landscaping, construction, manufacturing
positions. So a lot of competition,
yep,
for jobs that we have normally associated with teenagers or with that first job.
Exactly. I mean, you look at Philly, we've got good growth in accommodation, food services, a lot of entry-level jobs, but not a lot of kids getting those jobs.
Chikima, let me turn to you, and you're president and CEO of the Philadelphia Youth Network. As you look at Philadelphia, you've been doing this for about 15 years or so. What do you see?
You know, first thing I'd like to say is that I see young people filled with potential and not enough opportunity. And so to Paul's point about competing with older workers, young people need opportunities that help them learn workplace skills so that they can be competitive in the workplace. The other thing that I see is that without opportunity, we know that the lifetime earnings are much lower for populations. And so I see a city that's poised to really respond and respond proactively by ensuring that young people are able to actually acquire these skills and work not only in the summer but all year long.
And what kind of work skills are you talking about?
I'm specifically referencing what we used to call soft skills, which I'll call essential skills, right? Those things that everybody needs to succeed, those transferable skills like teamwork and collaboration, productivity and accountability, self-direction and initiative, being able to communicate effectively and build relationships with adults and peers, being able to troubleshoot and problem solve and plan and respond and be accountable for your behavior. Those are traits that any employer would want, and that's what we help young people learn.
And would it be fair to say that this summer there are teenagers with all those skills and they cannot find work in Philadelphia?
Absolutely. Every year, for the past 3 years, we've had 18,000 young people apply to Work Ready Philadelphia for summer employment. So the thought that young people don't want to work or don't have the inclination to do so is just false in our opinion, and our data shows that. What we don't have is equal amounts of opportunity and resources to respond to every young person who wants to apply.
So if 18,000 show up, how many actually get a job?
Less than half. Less than half.
So about 9,000. Let me turn to you, Sarah. And as I said in my introduction, you did some interesting research looking at youth actually in Chicago. Help us understand what this research was about and what you found.
Yeah, so I think Chicago faces all of the same challenges that Shakima just mentioned in Philadelphia. About double the number of youth apply to their summer opportunities program than they actually have room to provide opportunities for. But the mayor there, Mayor Emanuel, has really viewed summer jobs as violence prevention.
As crime prevention.
Yeah, and violence in particular, right? Summer is a time when violence really spikes. And so, and that makes a lot of sense, right? There's lots of reasons we might think that summer jobs would reduce violence. Youth are earning money. They're learning these jobs and these soft skills. They're getting connections to employer networks that might sort of reduce crime down the line. And they're just staying busier, right? If you're physically in an office working, you're not on the corner getting into trouble. But, you know, the theory isn't totally clear cut, right? Youth are earning money. We're not telling them what they have to spend that money on. It might be things we don't want them to spend it on. We're also keeping them busy generally during the day, whereas most crime happens on nights and weekends. So the city of Chicago sort of set out to answer the question, which of these forces wins out? Really, do summer jobs reduce violence like we think they should? So we set up this study. You know, the fact that the program is oversubscribed means that you have to allocate the slot somehow. So the way that we allocated it was via a lottery, totally fair way to sort of allocate the slots, and sets it up sort of like a clinical trial in medicine, right, where you have a group that's offered the program, a group that's not. In the absence of the program, those groups are totally equal, right? Their outcomes should be the same. So we can sort of track them over time, look at their outcomes, and figure out really what is the effect of the summer jobs
program. So some got jobs and some did not.
Exactly, because the number of slots are just limited, right? It's not that we took anything away from anyone. It's just we don't have enough slots. And so because the city set up the program this way with a lottery, we can isolate the effect of the program. And so I tracked youth in administrative data, in particular from the Chicago Police Department. And what we found is sort of striking is that 16 months after the lottery, so after the sort of everyone applied, violent crime arrests went down by 43%. So that's about 4 fewer arrests per every 100 youth offered the program, which is a striking decline in violence over time, right? So this is sort of some of the first really rigorous evidence that summer jobs really do reduce violence, that's the force that wins, and not just during the summer, but long after the program.
And so this was a summer job program, but you saw effects, or you looked at the effects a year or more than a year later and found a pretty dramatic decline.
Exactly. So, you know, if it were just the fact that they were staying busier over the summer, you'd see the drop only during the summer, and then everyone would sort of go back to whatever they were doing afterwards. But that's not what happened. That decline in violence really accrued after the program was over, which tells us they're learning something in these summer jobs that they're taking with them that's changing their future behavior in a very positive way.
Paul, should we think of a summer job program as an anti-crime program? Is that a helpful way to think about
that? Well, I think that's one of the ways to think about it. You know, the number of kids in the U.S., we estimate the number of kids that would like to have a summer job, have a job desire, unemployed or trying to get a job. It's about 2.5 million. It's a lot of youngsters. And very heavily concentrated in cities, but the gains to work experience for kids just are not relegated to, you know, reducing the amount of antisocial activity. There's also some positive things associated with this. That longer term studies that have tracked kids' employment and earnings experiences over time suggest that kids, when they're employed, when they're young, you know, 16, 17, 18, and if you ask your listeners how old were they when they got their first job, it's not going to be 22 mostly.
No.
You find that there are these, you know, holding educational attainment, basic skills, other factors constant. This is pretty substantial employment earnings gain. These kids just do better. And I think part of that's got to do with the chance to develop some of these, you know, work-based skills. You know, the place to do that is, you know, working.
But does it matter the kind of job? I mean, I think about some of the summer jobs I had, and, you know, some of them were more interesting than others. Some of them taught me more things than others. Is it a job, just a job by itself, or does it need to include something else? Let me toss that to you. Shakima, looks like you want to say something.
Sure. I think that there are a couple of things that are really important about the type of job. The first is that the experience has to be developmentally appropriate. So to Paul's point about younger exposure, we would not, just as I would not give my five-year-old keys to my car, we have to think about what are the appropriate experiences. And the Work Ready system has done a really good job of articulating different types of experiences as young people develop. So that's the first point. The second thing is sometimes the jobs are not terribly interesting.
Right.
But it's equally important to learn what you like,
right?
And what you don't like as well. And so it's really focused on putting young people in an experience where they can connect with caring adults. We call them workplace mentors or worksite supervisors. What is learned both by the adults and the young people, what we know, Sarah talked about the benefits, and we know this anecdotally from our work, is that young people contribute a considerable amount of innovation, energy. Their growth is exciting to employees while they're on site. And that provides mutual learning. And so often we focus on what do young people learn, but it's really important to note that the learning happens both and bidirectionally. Adults are changed by having young people in the workplace as well.
And that's a very important point. Paul, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, part of the reason why kids, I think, have trouble getting jobs is they send bad signals. They don't know how they go to a retail trade store with a pal and a Coca-Cola in their hand, and they ask for an application. And they just talk to the hiring supervisor, and they don't know that. And the hiring supervisor wrote the name down, and they're off the list.
Right.
So there's sort of ways to do this. There's a kind of a labor market savvy that kids need to develop, and they need to get that early rather than later. And so I think to Shakima's point, it is sensible to kind of get these kids oriented and focused on the labor market, particularly kids in low-income areas where the majority of adults don't work. So the labor market savvy is not in abundance in those places.
Sarah, you want to weigh in on that?
And I think there's all sorts of sort of skills and behaviors that are very adaptive in low-income neighborhoods. So, right, when you're walking down the street, you don't want to make eye contact with people. That's not a good idea. It's seen as a challenge. But if you're going and walking in and talking to a hiring supervisor and not making eye contact, that's a very different setting, right? And so having someone to sort of teach you those basic skills, right, those aren't things you're born with. You sort of learn to adapt to whatever your neighborhood teaches you is the right behavior. I think that's something else that we can sort of help to teach young people in these sorts of supported summer job settings.
And in Chicago, were there caring adults, as Shakima said, were there mentors who helped these young people who did have jobs?
Yeah, it's a really interesting part of their program. They call them job mentors as well. And so they hire adults just for the summer at a ratio of about 10 to 1, so 10 youth to 1 adult mentor. And their job is to help them from beginning to end with their barriers to employment. So whether that's transportation to work, whether it's family challenges, whether it's conflicts with supervisors. So we hear a lot that, the mentors are sort of a key point at which youth are prevented from getting fired, right? There's some conflict and there's a person there to sort of intervene. And, to me, that's sort of interesting when you look at the results being focused on violent crime and not other types of crime, because violent crime is also about conflicts with people, right? By definition, violence is a conflict with another
Sure.
person. And so perhaps learning some of these sort of conflict management skills, learning to think a little bit more slowly before you react. So one of the employers in Chicago told me one of the biggest challenges youth face when they walk through the door is how defensive they are. So you say, you have to wear closed-toed shoes to work, and they blow up in your face. And so the employer said, we try to work on that. And those are the same sorts of skills that might help with violence on the street, too.
I know you want to add something. They're playing my song. We have to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. We are talking about summer jobs for teenagers and even more broadly about employment and young people. Talking with Sarah Heller, Paul Harrington, and Shakima Fulmore Townsend. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. Much more. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're talking about the job opportunities for young people in our region, also about the important life skills that they can learn on the job. And to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me quickly reintroduce our guests, Sarah Heller, Assistant Professor in Criminology at the University of Pennsylvania, Paul Harrington, Director of the Center for Labor Markets and Policy at Drexel University, and Shakima Fulmore Townsend, President and CEO of the Philadelphia Youth Network. And Shakima, I know you wanted to add something right before the break. take?
Sure. Sarah referenced the social behaviors of work that can be learned. And I think it's important that at every step of the way, young people have the opportunity to practice those skills. And in Work Ready Philadelphia, we mimic those conditions by, one, having all young people apply online. That means that they have to show some level of technological savviness, and they have to have appropriate emails. I think the other important point is that young people need opportunities to succeed and opportunities to recover from failure. Mm. So this idea about defensiveness is also a learning moment. And what we also need to work on is preparing adults to respond to that. Oftentimes, we encounter adults who are uncomfortable by that defensiveness, and Work Ready supports the adults in addressing that. But it's not good enough for us to lower the expectations for young people, especially in low-income communities. We have to set the bar high, but also help them to achieve it by educating them and allowing them opportunities to learn.
But what I also hear you saying is that it requires a certain kind of adult to be able to deal with teenagers. I mean, it's true for teachers. It's true for adults in a community.
Absolutely. I always say, you know, we're working to prepare young people so they become work ready. But often I encounter adults who are not work ready. And so the reality is work readiness is seen as this destination when it's really a journey. When you go to a new job, you have to learn the culture of that organization. You have to learn what's acceptable behavior. You have to learn how to manage up, down, and around. Young people are responding to those same cues. And to Paul's earlier point about them sending signals, we as adults have to be prepared to read those signals and to ask additional questions and not assume that we understand the signals that they're sending.
Paul, I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is for many young people, they live in poor communities where there aren't jobs and maybe there aren't adults that they see that hold jobs. And in many ways, finding a job is who you know. I mean, it almost doesn't matter where you live or what socioeconomic factor is part of your life. It's the people that you know that can say, oh, I have a friend, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, labor market, and like a lot of other markets, labor market is still a social institution. You know, it is these kind of networks of personal connections, you know, still count. So when we took a look at the data both for Philadelphia and for the U.S. and asked ourselves a simple question, what's the connection between household income and the chance that a kid works? It's a very strong relationship. And it's a positive one. As household income rises, the chance of a kid finding work, you know, both in the summer and during the year, goes up pretty substantially until you get to the very top of the income distribution, and then it kind of drops back down a little bit. And I think, you know, and I don't have all the answers to this, but I think part of this is that these are in higher income or, you know, middle income families, upper middle income families, there's a strong work ethic, and there's a stronger ability to use these kind of social networks to get kids jobs. The other part of this is, though, is that increasingly we're seeing very large numbers of traditional teen employers, particularly big organization retail trade firms, using online applications. And the online application itself has embedded within them almost universally a set of personality profile questions and also actually sometimes psychological tests. And so these are designed to, you know, screen workers in and out. And there's two kinds of these. There's the kind of up, down, you're in, you're out kind of test. And then there's, you know, red, yellow, green light test. And you find those more in franchises like McDonald's and the like. And the problem is that kids are not really prepared to take these tests, in part because they don't know they are. When I've spoken with kids who've applied to these big box forms, I say, now, did you take any kind of test? And the answer is, well, no, we haven't done that. And then I say, okay, did they ask you a question about, you know, whatever the topic is? And they say, oh, yeah, they asked us practical everyday questions. So a consequence of that is, and there's some evidence to suggest that when kids don't know they're being tested, they do lousy.
Oh, so they don't take it. I mean, they don't understand the import.
Yeah, they don't understand the import of it. Also, a lot of times what these kids are doing is that, and these tests can take several hours sometimes, so and kids are doing these on these handheld devices, and they're time limited in certain instances. So if you don't have a good kind of internet connection and a good set of equipment to complete this thing, you'll do very poorly.
What about just going down to the corner store and finding out if someone is looking to hire somebody? I mean, does that still exist, or is it all kind of computerized now?
Walk-in employment for kids is still, you know, still very much a possibility. But again, the question is, how do you present yourself? And the problem is, when we've, you know, done these studies of employers, we just find that employers see kids on average presenting themselves, you know, in a less effective way than particularly older workers or, you know, young kids calling out of college. You know, when you ask employers at entry-level positions, why do you hire a college grad? Well, their answer is a simple one, because I can. You know, there's still a lot of that supply out there.
Well, I wonder too, Sarah, going back to the study in Chicago, the young people that got jobs, were they able to retain them, hold on to them? Did that in any way factor into some of these outcomes?
So, I think the program providers work very hard to try to make those year-round connections, and the hope is that by connecting people to employers, by getting that line on your CV, right, that's changing some of the initial impression as well. So we're still sort of tracking employment outcomes in Chicago. There was another study in New York that actually suggested that there wasn't necessarily a long-term employment effect, although, you know, there's still years and years.
Sure.
The sort of trajectory of labor force is very long, although they did also in New York find a decline in mortality that they think is due to reduced homicide. So, you know, I think there's we want to sort of think about the whole package of outcomes there as well. But Chicago is also starting to incorporate new workforce development training and sort of targeting particular sort of 21st century workforce skills to try to develop in order to have a bigger impact on later employment.
But even, Paul, going back to some of the research that your organization has been doing, but if only, let's say in Philadelphia, I think this was last year, so if only 10% of African-American males had a summer job, is that
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That means 90% didn't.
I mean,
is it people don't want to hire African-American males?
Yeah, I mean, there's a combination of things. One is still not a great job market in Philly, better, but not great. Two is that these kids are growing up in cultures where the majority of adults don't work. So the kid's ability to kind of get hooked in is probably diminished. Three, employers sort of have a bias against kids, you know, generally. And four, I don't know, maybe there is something about a racial aspect and particularly for black guys, because we don't see the same thing for black girls.
You don't?
No. You know, that has not fallen. Their employment rates are low, but they have not come down the way they have for black males.
You want to weigh in on that, Shakima?
Well, I think We've taken a look at our data, and actually nearly a third of our participants were African-American males. But I think some of the things that we've put in place systemically are linked to addressing that. Specifically, we have relationships with entities that serve these populations in high dosages. The opportunities we are trying to create and respond to that particular need through our partnership with My Brother's Keeper Philadelphia. So there are a couple of systemic barriers that we're going after in order to reduce the disparities in employment for African-American males.
And I think Mayor Nutter gets some credit for trying to expand that. He's seen the research. You know, he approached me about my research in Chicago. He sort of put out a call to have 10,000 opportunities for youth this summer. And Philadelphia Youth Network is filling an awful lot of those opportunities. You know, everyone is sort of still, even today, trying to pull in more funding to get more opportunities. So I think, you know, the city is aware of the sort of benefits of summer jobs and is doing everything they can.
Well, would you hire a teenager? Have you hired a teenager? Join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we are talking about youth employment, or in the cases of some young people, youth unemployment, some of the connections to reducing crime rates. Also, obviously, some of the skills that can be learned on the job that can open up opportunities for young people as they move into adulthood. And again, talking with Sarah Heller, Assistant Professor of Criminology at the University of Pennsylvania, Shakima Fulmore-Townsend, President and CEO of the Philadelphia Youth Network, and Paul Harrington, Director of the Center for Labor Markets and Policy. Paul, I'm thinking sort of the haves, I guess, and have-nots, but we see this kind of disparity. As you say, the more income you see in a family, the more job opportunities for young people.
Mm-hmm.
So they get a leg up into the job market. They get the experience. Perhaps they meet someone. You know, it's the kind of who you know factor. And if you're disadvantaged, you don't have those same opportunities.
Well, I would think there's maybe two ways of thinking about that. One is there certainly is this income effect. That is, income rises, kids' chance of getting employed is better. And I think that's got to do with that, you know, the labor market as a social institution. But the second thing is when you look at the geography of employment for teens, you see this huge interstate variation in employment rates. And there's just nothing like a full employment economy to get a kid a job.
Sure.
So when you go out to South Dakota, you'll find the employment rate out there is about 60%. 6 out of 10 kids have a job at any point in time. North Dakota, Nebraska, you know, right through that kind of, you know, if you will, the Keystone Pipeline potential area.
I know exactly
right?
what you're talking about.
You know, just tremendous opportunity. Very high labor force participation rates for adults. as you move, you know, east, particularly you get into the big urban areas and the like, you have, you know, lower labor force attachment for everybody. And that's especially a problem, not just now for 16 to 19-year-olds. Mm-hmm. We're also seeing bigger problems for people 20 to 29.
Oh, interesting.
There's greater disconnection there as well. Exactly.
And I mean, not to belabor this, but, I mean, it longer takes you to establish an employment record. I mean, you're just sort of behind the eight ball in terms of income and stability and all the things that come with that.
Yeah, there's some reasons I think that where you start in the labor market and where you end up are pretty closely connected. And so the people that don't have a strong, you know, lift, and there's different ways to get that. It's not all about working. But work is a complement to educational attainment. It is not a substitute. And too often, I think, Marcy, we think of work as a substitute for schooling, not as a complement to it. I think that's a mistake.
You're nodding your head, Jakima.
Absolutely, because I think that it's important both to experience the academic successes, but also to connect what's happening in school to work. And that's why we have a project-based learning approach, so that young people are not only learning those 21st century skills I referenced, but they're also having an opportunity to write and present at the end of their six-week experience. And those are skills that they need in their everyday academic life.
And did you find, Sarah, from your study in Chicago, work affect school performance? Was there a connection there?
So we are sort of keeping our eye on that. We haven't seen any sort of increased school engagement yet, although I think there's some evidence from New York that suggests there's some small increases in terms of days present and test taking that they need to do in New York to graduate. But I think it's also sort of one of the ways I think about the benefits of summer jobs is that we're reaching kids while they're still in school, before they've had these gaps open up in their employment history, before they've sort of faced the full-time labor market by themselves. And I think some of the follow-up work I'm doing in Chicago is starting to show this, that giving summer jobs to youth while they're still in school might sort of have bigger effects than after they're out of school. So I think it's one of the benefits of thinking about these summer jobs programs for high school youth.
But should we think about employment beyond the summer, Jakima? I mean, think, you know, perhaps it's a good thing for a young person to work 10 hours a week or 7 hours a week or 5 hours a week?
Absolutely. Year-round employment is equally as important as the summer opportunity. The study that Sarah referenced in New York showed that attendance grew tremendously after having a summer employment. And I have heard Paul, I've been around Paul enough to know, he says all the time, attendance is a great predictor for employers in terms of selecting a quality candidate. So we can't underestimate the importance of showing up. Attendance really matters. And what work offers is the opportunity for kids to practice that every day.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. So, Paul, you see a connection between showing up at school and showing up at work?
Yeah, attendance is it's really interesting that kids' high school behavior really is very predictive of a lot of stuff. You know, holding, you know, kind of even after you've accounted for the kids, you know, sort of PSSA test scores and for their high school GPA and some other things, you just find that showing up just is a tremendous predictor of their post-high school experiences. So, yeah, you know, Woody Allen had it right. 90% of life is showing up.
And showing up on time. I mean, show up means that you care, you're responsible.
Well, because
people can rely on you.
So I made an estimate of what the size of the entry-level job market is in Philadelphia, and it's about 9 or 10% of all the jobs. So what's an entry-level job? It's a job where cognitive abilities don't count very much. It's a job where specific knowledge doesn't count very much. What counts is these behavioral traits that Jakima mentioned. Being respectful of people you work with, being reliable, being dependable, and I think most importantly, having self-control. And these are really the traits that employers emphasize, you know, when they're talking about teens and where they see problems. So to the extent that we can kind of figure out ways to have an impact on improving that behavior, and, you know, my guess is there's some reason to think that, then we'll probably get some gains.
Let me see looks like Tim from Wayne has to say. And Tim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I owned a small business, a retail store out in Wayne, suburban Philadelphia, and most of my teenage employees were white middle class, and my family and I owned the shop for 20 years, and we saw a real decline in teenage kids' ability to work in a retail setting where you have to look people in the eye. You have to be able to talk to people. The interpersonal skills really has declined for kids since their use of tablets, phones, keyboards, et cetera, has gone up. You know, we saw a real dramatic decline, and so that we had to, at the end, you know, last couple of years, we really have to teach them more about how to talk to people, interpersonal skills, than we did really to train them for the. For the retail job, and I'm wondering if your guests could to speak to that.
Sure, Tim. No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and it's great that you took that initiative to help these young people. But he's describing, Shakima, a kind of a fall off in social skills.
Absolutely, and I think what's commendable to you, Tim, is that you recognized that early and as an employer invested in the training. I think what we know about young people is that they're incredibly resilient and incredibly adaptive. And so they are able to increase what they do on a regular basis. So if they don't interact with adults in a positive way regularly or communicate directly regularly, then that is what tends to proliferate. When we interrupt that cycle and teach them new skills, they can also mimic that. And I think what we're seeing is just the real need to learn and teach. And I can't underemphasize enough how important these experiences are to their development and growth. You're not picking an employee who is perfect. You're picking an employee who will become perfect for you as you work with them. And what we've seen time and time again, I have students who were in ninth grade with us at the Philadelphia Youth Network. They're now my seasonal employees. And the growth has been tremendous. And it's been a lot of investment, but the return is great. I have a team of seasonal employees implementing our summer program because we invested in those young people.
About a minute before our break here, Paul, but should we blame it on the cell phone?
Yeah, so Peter Capelli, my colleague over at Penn, had done very similar sets of studies that we, you know, back in the early 1990s, as we've done in the last few years. And basically, employers just always rate kids at the bottom of the queue. You know, they just have not great behavior. The difference, I think, is you know, the 1990s and, you know, maybe 2006, 2007, you know, it's just a better economic environment in part. And kids now are with this bad economic environment we've had for the last 5 or 6 years, kids are just back in the bottom of that queue. Kids' behaviors, I think, are always something that employers have to deal with and respond to. You know, I commend Tim because Tim has said, I'm going to hang in with these kids.
That's right.
And other employers have said, I'm going to find other sources of labor supply.
Well, let's take a short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about summer employment for teenagers and even beyond that, talking about employment around the year, around the clock for young people. And again, our guests are Shakima Fulmore Townsend, president and CEO of the Philadelphia Youth Network, Paul Harrington, director of the Center for Labor Markets and Policy, and also professor in the School of Education at Drexel University, and Sarah Heller, assistant professor in criminology at the University of Pennsylvania. We'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about teens and employment, focusing on summer jobs to some extent, but even speaking more broadly than that. And again, talking with Shakima Fulmore-Townsend, Paul Harrington, and Sarah Heller. And calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And a question I asked earlier, which is, have you hired teenagers? Let me get Lisa from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Lisa, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
So I run a urban farming program that it's basically using urban farming as a medium to create job opportunities for our disadvantaged youth. And one thing that I actually will be taking some work-ready students this summer. One thing I've run into in the time that I've worked with youth is a lot of why we say disadvantaged is there just has not been enough opportunities for these kids. So it's trying to create opportunities. But the problem that I have run into, and I think a lot of my peers have run into as well, is holding some of these young people to a level of personal responsibility. So how much of it is understanding that there's been a lack of opportunity versus you need to step up to the plate? And I just would like to hear what your guests have to say on that topic.
Indeed. And Shakima, go back to you. But Sarah, I'd like to hear from you and Paul as well.
Well, I'm a strong proponent of high expectations for young people. I do not believe in changing the bar, and part of our process is around orientation and setting the expectations for young people about how they should behave in the workplace. I think where I see some challenge is how do we build capacity in adults to do that in a both loving, productive, and instructive way? It is a very uncomfortable thing for adults to do, to hold each other accountable. And when young people are in a different place than you are, it is often a trap, a real dangerous trap, to feel so sorry or sorry for them that you don't actually educate them. And sometimes we have teachable moments. When I say they recover from failure, one of the hardest things to do is to fire a young person because they have continued to lack personal responsibility. But to do that in an instructive way is really important. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we support as an organization is how to help adults do that well.
You want to weigh in on that, Sarah?
I mean, I totally agree with that. And I think one of the things I've learned from working from Chicago is the role of the program staff in doing that. That I think you have your role in providing those jobs, and it sounds like you're very invested in helping youth develop. But it also shouldn't necessarily be the employer's responsibility when we're spending government money on programs to ensure that every youth succeeds, that we sort of are providing staff to help you as employers make that a successful experience. And, you know, at the end of the day, there may be some youth who are not going to learn those lessons, and that doesn't mean that we should sort of continue employing them. That's sometimes an important lesson to learn, too. But I think providing the right kind of support and instruction in the program setting is one of the benefits of having summer jobs programs that are sort of sponsored by someone other than employers.
And it's interesting. I think our caller talked about, you know, whether they felt sorry for someone, or perhaps, Shakima, you said that as well. And sometimes with young people, they have chaotic lives. Things happen at home. The car breaks down. There's a fight in the house. I'm just thinking of all the things that can happen. I mean, that could be an excuse for not showing up on time.
Right, it is. But at the end of the day, if you're running a retail, you know, establishment, you got a restaurant, you're working 60 hours a week, and a kid's supposed to come in and wash the dishes at 6 o'clock Saturday morning, it doesn't show,
right,
you're not taking a kid to the zoo that day, you're washing the dishes. And so while, right, there are legitimate excuses and the like, at the end of the day, we can't be placing all kids. That an effective education and training program, one of the things they do is screen kids, you know, and you got to do a good job making sure this kid's ready to go out there, has the self-control, has the reliability, the dependability, because at the end of the day, I don't think you're doing a kid a favor by placing them in a job that they're not capable of doing. And if a kid comes from a chaotic life, that needs to be dealt with before we try and place that kid to a job or resolve education problems or anything else.
So, go ahead, Shakima.
Well, and that speaks to readiness. I mean, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we have to meet the basic needs first before we can put young people in employment. And that's why the supportive services are so critical. But I agree with Paul 100% that young people have to be stabilized well and have to be screened well. They also have to be taught what is appropriate. We can't change the standard. When they grow, we do them no favors by changing the standard. When they become adults, your employer, as my husband says every day, he has a small business. It is show business, not show friends. And so at the end of the day, we do them a disservice when we don't prepare them for what the real world will actually hold them accountable to.
Go ahead, Sarah.
And I think one of the exciting things that comes out of the research I do is that sometimes it doesn't take very long to teach those lessons, right? So, you know, we have this sense that we have to invest all of this time and money and learning, but really, you know, maybe 13 sessions, maybe a short 6 to 8 week summer job program can actually teach those lessons, which I think is very heartening.
Lisa, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. We are talking about youth unemployment, or youth employment, I should say. And we want to hear from you if we'd be curious about the kind of youth jobs you might have had, and if you have hired young people, what your experience was. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let's get Mike from Germantown to join us. Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. My original question. Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
My original question had to do with academics versus culture, and your panelists very much answered that. I really wish that the panelists, their philosophy was woven into the Philadelphia school system, because I can see it going a long way in fixing the problem. I really loved what Tim said, too. But the mayor, would you suggest to the mayor that instead of those 10,000 job opportunities being a lottery, life's a lottery, wouldn't it be interesting if he threw a performance thing in there, like for the kids that missed the fewest number of days of school, they're at the top of the list, so that, in fact, what you do has consequences. It seems like that's a message that that is missing. And I really like what you said, because I think that's why the public schools were invented. It was to provide people with entry-level skills so they could work in the factories and the offices and wherever else it is that they need to work, so that they could earn a living and support themselves. And I think that whole sort of element has gotten missed.
Well, you know, Mike, let me just jump in here. And you raise an interesting point, which is to figure out how to make a connection, I guess, between academic performance and the possibility of a job. Does Sarah, does that seem like something that would reward good behavior?
I think so. I mean, and I think that, you know, schools are on board with this. So, you know, most of my experiences in Chicago, I can talk about that a little bit better than I can talk about the Philadelphia schools. But in the Chicago public schools, they are also partnering with researchers to sort of evaluate programs that happen during the school day, where kids get pulled out of class and are learning some of these lessons about, you know, we talk about it as automaticity. So there's this sort of automatic behaviors of getting defensive, of sort of acting without thinking, that, and these programs are designed to reduce that, to make people make a little bit more reflective decisions, which can help in interacting with teachers, with employers, with peers on the street. And I think, you know, schools understand that it's not just reading, writing, and arithmetic, but that it's these kinds of programs that are also worthwhile in the school day.
You want to add to that?
Yeah, I part of the problem, I think, in the country is that we've become one-trick ponies in the secondary school system. We just want to put everybody in the post-secondary college and university system, and it's just a mistake. The consequence of that is we get, you know, when you take a look at Philadelphia, I gave a talk to all the career and tech ed teachers in the city about a month ago, and I thought to myself, okay, there's going to be tons and tons of people out there. There was 150 teachers from the entire school district. In Massachusetts, that's one school. So when I saw the size of this, I just really brought home to me how little we have here in terms of alternatives for kids, and, you know, pathways that can kind of get them, you know, tied into the labor market in an effective way. And when you look at the record of, you know, really well organized career tech ed programs, tremendously effective in reducing dropout problems, reducing behavioral problems, much higher average daily attendance rates, better post-graduation outcomes, I mean, and good pathways into college if you want to go. So I think we've missed some things. I think our emphasis, certainly as a nation and to some extent in Philly, on everybody's got to go to college is probably a mistake.
You want to weigh in on that, Shakima?
Well, actually, I wanted to respond to the caller because our current system, while Chicago is on a lottery, I just want to make sure people understand this, our current system is not on a lottery. That is something that we've debated longstanding for years and have not made that transition. It really is the investments drive how young people are connected to the employments. Some funding sources, especially federal funding sources, come with a lot of regulations that have to be adhered to. I think the other important point is that we enjoy a great partnership with the School District of Philadelphia, and especially the career and technical education programs, as well as the comprehensive high schools, and try really intentionally to select young people who can participate and align, as well as those who have to go to summer school. We provide afternoon opportunities for those young people. It's important in order to decrease disparities, though, that we focus on young people who are doing well as those young people who are struggling. So I think it's a balance that we have to strike.
Let me see what Scott from Mount Airy has to say. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I'm a contractor, and I flip houses. And I make a real effort to hire young people who graduated from the Philadelphia public school system, just like I did. And what I'm finding, I'm 48 years old. These kids have no idea that, like, work is an obligation. You have to show up on time. But an employer doesn't want to hear your excuses. That if I can't make money on these kids by the hour, I can't employ them. And you know, they're treating me like I'm a parent. Like I'm supposed to listen continuously to what's going on in their lives and blah blah blah. You know. I'm here to make money, and that's how most employers are. And, you know, I care about them from the standpoint that I was a black kid, now I'm a black man, obviously. but, you know, it's just, I really can't hire these kids anymore because they won't show up, they won't do the job. And it's not that they won't work hard, because I hire kids who work super unbelievably hard, but then they don't come in the next day. And then, you know, and then I have to listen. Then I have to listen to the excuses. And let's not even talk about. I can't find one kid so far. I guess in the last 4 or 5 years, I've probably hired 6 or 7 kids. I can't find one kid who can identify for me what an eighth of an inch is on a ruler. I asked the kids, you know, what was the Holocaust? Half of them don't have no idea what the Holocaust was. I mean, I've got black kids who aren't even exactly sure when civil rights was. I mean, how are these kids ever going to be employable? They don't even know how to take a percentage. They don't even know how to find a percentage of a number.
Well, you know what, Scott? First of all, I appreciate your call. We hear your passion. We hear your frustration. Frankly, share it. And if I can toss it to you, Paul, I mean, what he's saying, look, I want to hire these young people. I can't do it because they can't do the work.
Yeah, right. So how do you respond to that? And part of the way, I hired a kid from the Philadelphia School District about 3 years ago. And as an 18-year-old kid working with Excel, and now has kind of moved on to more sophisticated things. So how did I get this kid? Well, I went to the Philadelphia Academies, and I said, I want a really top-notch kid. So I had somebody screen this youngster for me. And that's what has to happen here, that you've got to, you know, just kind of, you know, picking a kid and hoping for the best. It's probably not going to work out. That hooking up with the organizations that have good connections to the high school and that can identify, you know, kids with the kind of proficiencies you need, particularly the career tech ed schools. One of the things I should say is when we did these studies, we found kids that graduated from career tech ed schools were very valued by employers.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah. Scott, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. So, Sarah, what do you do? I mean, we're hearing about kids that don't show up and they can't do the job. Do we just write them off as they grow into adulthood? How do we intervene?
I mean, you know, I think the unfortunate thing is with the whole push towards early education and early intervention, that there is some sense out there that we should just write them off, right, that if we don't get to them early, it's too late. And I think the research just does not support that idea, right? That we see summer jobs can have a huge life impact, that there are lots of other programs that can really turn things around for adolescents and even beyond. So I think, you know, we can't do everything, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything. And so I think looking at the places where we can make cost-effective investments, like in summer jobs, to sort of start that path, even though it's frustrating that we can't do everything, we should still be trying to sort of make those positive investments, especially when, you know, there's evidence that it really has a significant impact.
So what do you say, Chikima, to the adults out there? I mean, we heard from several of them. They want to hire, but they're frustrated. They don't know what to do.
First of all, their frustration is completely appropriate. Here's the deal. To all the adults who called in today, I want to be your screener. I want to be your connector. I know kids who can identify an eighth of an inch. I know kids who can build houses. I know kids who have the skills that he needs, that he's looking for. And what they don't have is adults like him who are giving them that opportunity every day. I want to help them become less frustrated and more productive in their day at work. So, go to at pyninc.org, connect with me, because I want to help change this perception. The other thing that I would say to adults is that we have a pool of young people who are continuously available and who are learning those skills that are going to make them a viable employees for them. And all we need is the opportunity to introduce them.
Final word from you?
Yeah,
I think
things are getting a little bit better this summer. I think the outlook for kids as the economy's improved is improving a little bit. But every time we get a kid a job, we've contributed to the human capital development and long-term productivity of the American economy. So all I can ask is for your readers is take a chance and hire a kid.
And to our listeners
as well.
That's okay. Anything you want to say as we say goodbye, Sarah?
I think I just echo those sentiments and say, you know, there will always be frustrations, but there are also success stories. You know, I talk to youth in these programs, and they talk to me about the pride they get from getting that first paycheck, from how, you know, they're wearing clothes they bought themselves that they never would have worn before, because now they understand it's important to put on a good face. And so I think for all the frustrations, we should also think about the successes as well.
Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times, talking about a really important issue. Sarah Heller, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's an assistant professor in criminology at the University of Pennsylvania. Paul Harrington, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marcy.
And he's director of the Center for Labor Markets and Policy, also a professor in the School of Education at Drexel University. And Chikima Fulmore Townsend, thank you very much as well. and she's the president and CEO of the Philadelphia Youth Network. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.